Hey, are we live yet? Are we live yet? Testing. 1, 2, 3. Welcome to Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's online podcast with your host, Jan Irvin. Here we investigate the religious, the mysterious, the entheogenic, the shamanic, and the Gnostic with the small g. Haven't heard it someplace else, you'll likely hear it here. So sit back and relax. Take a trip through time and a journey through your mind as we investigate the ancient mysteries.
Welcome to Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast number 19. I'm your host, Jan Irvin. Today's guest is Peter Webster. In the original 1978 edition of The Road to Ulysses by R. Gordon Wasson, Dr. Albert Hoffman, who was the inventor of LSD, and Professor Carl Ruck of Boston University, a proposal was made that the sacred and secret drink called Kaikion of the Greek Ulyssesian mysteries was derived from ergot. In this book, Dr. Hoffman proposed that the Greeks could have used a simple water extraction from ergot to make an LSD-like substance that would account for the strong effects of the Kaikion. However, over the decades since the book went to print, many people tested Dr. Hoffman's theories and were unable to make the drink psychoactive to the degree first proposed. Recently, new discoveries have been made by today's guests that may correct and corroborate Hoffman's original proposals. In 1992, Terence McKenna published a book called Food of the Gods, in which he made the claim that psychedelics, and especially psilocybe mushrooms, were the catalyst for human evolution. But more than 15 years has passed since McKenna first published this book. How well has his proposal stood the test of time, if at all? Peter Webster will provide an updated and corrected proposal that goes far beyond McKenna's original ideas. Peter Webster started researching psychedelics in Mexico in 1968 and became an underground chemist producing LSD in small quantities for a network of friends. He retired from such activities as the 1960s ideals melted away into the 1970s. He took a vacation from psychedelic research to run a yacht charter business in the Mediterranean and Red Sea during the late 1970s and 80s, finally settling down in southern France in the late 1980s to take up psychedelic research once again. Peter began writing drug policy articles for the International Journal of Drug Policy and other publications, and working on a general theory of psychedelic experience. He created the Psychedelic Library at www.psychedelic-library.org in the early days of the internet, and was a first branch of the druglibrary.org website. Parts of his general theory project then appeared on the website and elsewhere, one part as a suggested solution to the problem of Ulysses and its psychedelic potion, published first in the journal Ulysses, recently published in the 30th anniversary edition of The Road to Ulysses, and a second part of his theory how psychedelics influenced the emergence of modern man. Both of these subjects were then presented in lectures at the 2006 Basel Switzerland Hoffman Celebration. Recently, Peter started a complete rewrite of the general theory with a view to publication in hard copy. Again, next week's guest may be a mystery. All of my guests that I had planned for the next couple of weeks have had to postpone their interviews for a couple weeks due to travel and other projects, so I'll be interviewing them in early March. So next week's guest may be a surprise, but I hope to get Professor Tom Roberts on in the meantime, who is the author of Psychedelic Horizons and editing author of Psychoactive Sacramentals. Otherwise, I may play something from the She Who Remembers audio archives and upcoming shows when their projects and trips are complete are Professor Carl Ruck and The Hidden World. He is actually in Ulysses in Greece right now, so when he comes back, the information will be fresh in his head for our interview. Also upcoming will be Dr. Dennis McKenna and I think his work is well known and hardly needs to be said much about. And Professor Michael Winkelman, his book is called Supernatural is Natural, a Biocultural Approach to Religion, which happens to also propose a greatly expanded psychedelic evolutionary theory far beyond Terence McKenna's original proposals. I'm still seeking a volunteer to help me with the Hemp for Fuel website. If anyone can be in charge of finding fuel and energy related stories and submitting them to the website once or twice a week, it would probably only take 10 or 20 minutes each time. But I really need somebody to help with that, as I get so many projects on, it's hard to focus and keep myself on the projects that need to get done more importantly. So if you can help with that, maybe 40 minutes a week, I would hugely appreciate that. This show is run on donations, so if you would like to support this programming, please go to www.gnosticmedia.com and click on the donations button at the top left of the page. This show is not corporate media, and by supporting it, you help continue our programming. And without your help, we cease to be here. And I know times are tough, but if you are someone who can afford to support this show by donating a few dollars a month or a week or once, we greatly appreciate it. And thanks to everyone who took me up on the damaged book proposal over the last week. I really appreciate your help on that. I still have quite a few copies of those left if anyone wants one. For those of you who donate $10 or more, I'll send you a free damaged copy of the second black and white edition of Astrotheology and Shamanism that just came out. During the shipment from the printer who packaged the books very poorly, the box broke open, and as I mentioned last week, the entire case dumped on the post office floor. All but five of the books were damaged at the post office. And basically what the printer requires is that I cut off the front covers of all of the damaged books and submit them back to the printer so that they can replace them. I'm supposed to destroy the books, but they're, you know, I'm not supposed to sell them, but there's nothing that says I can't give them away. And pretty much the extent of damage is bent corners and pages, black marks, etc. Most of the books have only minor damage, but obviously the front covers are cut off. So anyway, I would greatly appreciate anyone who helps take these off my hands. And this is for USA orders only, as these will be shipped via media mail, which is about $2.54 each. I cannot afford to do the international orders on this deal because international orders are typically anywhere from $12, $13 up to $16, $17 a piece, so that would be more than the donation. And let's see. Oh, I suppose I have about, if I didn't already say so, about 20 copies of those left. I also have copies of the brand new color edition of Astrotheology and Shamanism that went to print on April 4th. And the color edition is shipping now. I just shipped out all of the orders that have come in so far this week. So if you would like to get a numbered autographed copy of the second color edition of Astrotheology and Shamanism, you can do that from the Gnostic Media website. Included with that will be a free copy of the Pharmacratic Inquisition DVD, which alone is a $20 value, so you're getting basically $20 off of that offer. And I also have copies of my newest book, The Holy Mushroom, which are autographed, if you would like one of those, also available on the website. Could greatly use your support on that, so please go to www.gnosticmedia.com. That's gnosticmedia.com. And if you would like to contact me, feel free to contact me at contact@gnosticmedia.com. And here's my interview with Peter Webster. And I'm here with Peter Webster. And Peter, welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
Thanks, Jan. It's a pleasure that that you asked me. I got to admit, I'm sort of embarrassed. I didn't even know about your website or all the great interviews that are on there. So I'm quite pleased to be amongst all these famous people that you've interviewed. I hope I can live up to the standard that you've already already supplied here.
Well, I hope so, and that's sort of why I'm having you on, so that we can go into some of your fascinating research that I think holds a lot of merit and deserves more attention. You know, it's kind of interesting regarding your work is one of your videos, I think, was out for close to 2 years before I stumbled across it one day. And in fact, I think you or Carl Ruck may have sent me your video the first time. So, you know, I was kind of surprised that I had never heard of your work before that point. And so let's get it out there.
Well, I hope so. You know, all scientific fields turn into something a bit conservative, and most people only hear about the mainstream ideas. So, you know, there's not too many revolutionaries, even in psychedelic research. There's some important ones, but we don't necessarily all get heard that widely. So I hope this interview will remedy that situation.
Likewise. And do you want to start up with a little bit about your background?
Well, I grew up in the 1950s. Weird times. I grew up in a small town out on eastern Long Island, about 2 hours from New York. You know, everybody was straight in those days, but of course we didn't have any reference point to judge that. It's only afterwards we could see how strange those times were. God, I remember McCarthyism and learning in civil defense exercises how to duck and cover when the A-bombs would start to drop. This is all serious stuff back there. Now, I remember my third grade teacher telling the class that we didn't have any propaganda in America, but all those Russians, geez, you know, they were weird times. Luckily for me, I had some influences that prepared me for going my own way. So when the opportunities knocked, I was ready for them. You know, I contacted some of my friends from high school days and before, and it seems I was about the only one to escape being a small town, support the troops American for the rest of my life. What a lucky break.
How did you get into this field of research?
Well, you know, I was very interested in chemistry when I was 6, 7 years old. I always had a chem lab in the basement of my house, so it was sort of natural that I would take my university courses in chemistry. The trouble is, I found that in the end, I was really much less interested in the heavy theoretical matters of chemistry than the equipment. I loved the equipment and how to use it. I even I took great pleasure in making devices and apparatus for experiments. That seemed much more an enjoyable thing than worrying about all the the theoretical detail. You know, after 4 years at the university, I didn't even graduate, by the way. I considered looking for a job and working with scientific instrumentation. That was my main interest and talent, or even selling it, you know. But I got a notice from the draft board. You know, this was 1967, and I had made a lot of new friends. I'll call them entrepreneurs in the New York East Village scene. And instead of getting a job, I quickly went off to Mexico to avoid the draft. But I also went there to do some research on peyote and also on Ololuqui, which is, that famous shamanic drug that's made out of morning glory seeds. Well, I had already proved myself to the East Village crowd by preparing a small batch of LSD. And we thought it might be possible to process morning glory seeds to that end, since getting the raw material to make LSD was a bit of a problem. Well, one thing led to the next, as they notoriously do. And soon I found myself as a minor player in producing LSD in a series of hideaway underground laboratories. What days those were. So you see, my talents for the equipment of chemistry was just what I needed, because the chemistry of LSD is rather simple. I mean, you know, there's tricks and techniques that you've got to discover to do it well. But mainly it's being able to set up equipment, make equipment, and know how to have a very minimal place and yet make a good product. You know, it was so easy in those days. you can walk into almost any chemical supply house and you can buy anything you want, almost. I mean, you know, you couldn't buy, well, you know, the things you can't buy. But anything you really needed, you could buy. No questions asked. Pay cash over the counter. What great days those were. These days, I don't even dare keep a beaker exposed in my house for, oh, well.
So, you now live in France. What took place to cause you to move there? I can only guess, but I want to hear your story.
Well, first of all, the military draft. I wasn't about to go to Vietnam. I mean, I wasn't really aware in those days what kind of horror that was being actually committed there. I was still infected with the 1950s propaganda that America was great, and if we were doing it, there must be a good reason for it. Well, anyway, the military draft, you know, that got me out of America, got me out into the rest of the world, and wow, I discovered the rest of the world was a really interesting place. That's another almost anti-American thing for a boy having grown up in the 50s. You know, America was the place. Here is the rest of the world. Again, one thing led to the next, and I took a vacation from my underground laboratory days after a while, and I found myself cruising around the Mediterranean in a 40-foot catamaran. I eventually wound up on the French Riviera. I don't know, it was some fairly obscure reason. That was a place I always thought I wanted to visit, but maybe it was fate, because it was on that cruise that I met my soulmate, and we proceeded to sail off into the sunset. Well, what followed was several years of a very profitable business in chartering our yacht with us as a captain and crew, and we entertained some of the rich, if not famous, in various tourist hotspots, in Ibiza, on the Riviera. Even we went to the Red Sea during the winters, and we got some of the rich Kuwaitis who used to vacation in Egypt in the winter. We used to take out all their wives and children while they went out antelope hunting. So you can imagine the kind of life we had for quite a few years. So we were out of the loop on matters psychedelic for many years. And that probably saved us from what might be called the meltdown of the 60s, when you know, so many of its idealists and entrepreneurs either got in trouble or became straight capitalist scammers instead. Eventually, we sold the boat and settled down here in the Southern Alps, and I began my reentry. This was in the 80s, meeting old contacts, getting acquainted with the psychedelic research and its practitioners as it had developed. And I started writing for a drug policy journal, creating a website on psychedelic matters back in the early days of the internet. That was my reentry into the whole thing.
And would you discuss the Eleusinian mysteries? What were they?
Well, oddly enough, during our final year or two cruising around on that wonderful boat, somebody sent me a book, which was probably one of the reasons I became a landlubber once again. And its title was The Road to Eleusis. And it caused me no end of meditation and reflections on what I'd learned in my more adventurous days. It was really the seed for all my ensuing work and writing. Eleusis was, and of course it still is, just a small town in Greece up the coast from Piraeus in Athens. But it was the site of a very special temple, the Telesterion. And it was there that an annual secret celebration of initiation was held over a period of nearly 2,000 years. Essentially, all the great names of Greek antiquity were initiated into this religious ceremony. And many insisted it was a life-changing event on a par with no other. The Road to Eleusis was, of course, the first important book to propose a comprehensive theory that a psychedelic sacrament was the only possible answer to the question of how a one-night stand in a musty old temple could bring universal enlightenment to so many great scholars, poets, philosophers, and even the general public. It was certainly no beer festival.
How did you come to study the mysteries?
Well, thinking about the book over a couple of years led me both to the idea that perhaps psychedelic plants might have played a universal long-term role in human societies. For here they were important in Greece, they were important in other societies that we hear about. And I thought perhaps even psychedelics might have played an evolutionary role for the emergence of modern humans. And my researches in Mexico and with synthesizing LSD had given me some clues as to how Albert Hofmann's proposals in The Road to Eleusis might have been implemented in ancient Greece. You know, because he proposed that, that it must have been this fungus ergot that the Greeks have used, but there wasn't really a satisfying theory of how they might have done it. So I began to read as much of the literature as I could find. And working with the clues from my own research, I soon came up with the idea that I first presented in an article in a journal of the same name. The journal was called Eleusis, too. And this was the first time I proposed an actual recipe for how the psychedelic potion that was used at Eleusis might have been made. And finally, I presented these ideas to the 2006 conference in Basel. It was the celebration of Albert Hofmann's 100th birthday. And this is where I probably reached my first large audience.
Well, let's see here. How is ergot similar to LSD and LSA, and how is that suggested to be a part of these mysteries?
Well, your listeners really should get familiar with the book, The Road to Eleusis, which is out. It's out in a new, inexpensive edition now, by the way. In order to understand the many clues, most of these clues are literary and are taken from the writings of the people at the time. And on mythology, I'm pretty weak. This is Karl Rucks' domain. If you read the book, though, the first few chapters, then you can see how many clues point towards ergot as being the most likely product that could have been used to prepare a psychedelic potion at Eleusis. My part was simply to come up with some kind of a recipe or a method for converting ergot, or the chemicals in ergot. These chemicals are normally poisonous, by the way, because ergot was the infestation that led to so many outbreaks of ergotism in the Middle Ages, a terrible disease. So the constituents of ergot are quite toxic normally. So my idea was to come up with a way in which, a very simple method, because obviously the Greeks didn't have any modern chem labs, they would have needed a simple method to convert these toxic alkaloids, these toxic chemicals in ergot, into a psychedelic product. Well, my findings are interesting because they tie together the ancient use of psychedelics in the New World with that in ancient Greece, because the recipe that I propose for making the kaikion, this is the potion that was used at Eleusis, my proposed recipe is a simple chemical process that converts the toxic products in ergot into exactly the same chemicals that are found in Ololuqui, which is the famous morning glory seed preparation used for centuries by Central American shamans. So here we have quite an amazing thing, that the same psychedelic substance was discovered and used by Central Americans and the ancient Greeks. Now, all these chemicals are derivatives of lysergic acid, by the way, and they're all very similar to LSD. LSD is the most potent and powerful of them, but there are a few others, especially LSA that you mentioned. This is lysergic acid amide, whereas LSD is lysergic acid diethyl amide. But LSA is supposedly about one-tenth as powerful as LSD, but that estimation remains to be shown exact as well.
Could you explain exactly what ergot is?
Yeah, ergot is a fungus. It's a primitive fungus. You can't really call it a mushroom, because a mushroom is a term that's reserved for the agarics, which are, you know, classical looking mushrooms that spring out of the ground, you know, like the fly agaric, Amanita muscaria. So it's a primitive fungus, and it infests cereal grains and other grasses too. And there are quite a number of different species of ergot, but it's only one of the species that we're really concerned with here. The species is called Claviceps purpurea, and it's a very common parasite of major food cereals like wheat, rye, and the main cereal crop in ancient Greece, which was barley. And even today, the fungus infests commercial fields. And this is, if you read the requirements for wheat or for rye, for instance, you'll find out that a certain number of ergots are allowed to exist in these grains, and it's still sold as wholesome grain. So it is even with modern agricultural techniques and all the fungicides they spray all over the place. So you can imagine in ancient crops that that ergot must have been quite prevalent in all the crops and all the wild grasses as well.
What was the original problem with theory that was presented by Dr. Albert Hoffman?
Yeah, actually it was Gordon Wasson that came up with the idea, and then confirmed by Carl Ruck that it might have been ergot that was used to prepare the kaikion of Eleusis. And then they asked Albert Hoffman if he could come up with a few ideas of how that might have been possible. And Hoffman came up with two ideas, and both of them turned out to be problematic. Hoffman's main hypothesis was that the way the ancients might have made toxic ergot into a psychedelic brew was to remove from the ergot the one moderately psychoactive chemical, and that's called ergonovine. And they would do this by treating the ergot with water, because the ergonovine is soluble and would go into the water, while the toxic alkaloids in ergot are not soluble. And the problem with that is that ergonovine is a very minor constituent of ergot, especially the Claviceps purpurea that we're talking about. And perhaps ergonovine is not even reliably present in most ergot. So, yeah, it's possible that you could extract some ergonovine from ergot and get a moderately psychoactive brew, but it seems unlikely that it would have been so dependable. Because remember, Eleusis went on for 2,000 years. Every year, they managed to make this very potent brew. So it had to be some kind of a method that was very reliable and used materials that were close at hand, and also that it was kept secret for all those 2,000 years. Nobody could really figure out how the Greek priests prepare this stuff. So all those requirements make Hoffman's proposals a bit problematic. Now, his second proposal, by the way, was that that perhaps ergots that were it wasn't the ergots that were growing on the barley crop, but perhaps the priests found that there were ergots that were growing on the wild grasses around the sides of the field. And Hoffman proposed this because there was a type of ergot called Paspalli. It's Claviceps paspalli is the name. And the reason they call it paspalli is because it grows on grasses of species of grass that are known as paspalum. And the interesting thing about this ergot is that it contains only the same substances that are in the ololiqui of Central America, the LSA and its derivatives. So, and it doesn't contain any of the toxic ergot. So this is why Hoffman thought it might be an attractive proposal. But that turned out to be problematic too, because Giorgio Sammarini, a very great psychedelic researcher from Italy, found that the paspalum grass, which is the necessary host for the type of ergot that grows on it, he found out that paspalum grasses are native to the New World and would not have been present in ancient Greece. So that pretty much eliminated the Hoffman's second idea. But there's still so many literary indications that ergot was what was used that it seemed to me that we hadn't come up with the right recipe or the right way that they could have used ergot. So that was the basis of my research and my work.
And you propose a new theory for processing ergot based on other information that you discovered, I would assume probably from reading the information on either in Road to Ulysses or Carl Ruck's other work about the goddess Persephone, who is the goddess of fire and ash and daughter of Demeter. Would you discuss this?
Yeah, well, that's the domain of the people that know the mythology. My mythology is as bad as my Greek, which is pretty much non-existent. In the book there, as I was just mentioned, there are so many literary indications from the writers and poets and philosophers of the time. You see, it was forbidden under pain of death to reveal anything you really knew about the Kaikion and this celebration. So all the references have to be shrouded in double entendre and secrecy and diversion, so that the people that said them wouldn't be prosecuted. But nevertheless, there's still enough indications in the literature, and if you read the book, you discover a lot of them, mostly revealed by Carl Ruck, so that you have to consider ergot before any other substance, because the literary references are so great. As far as ash goes, I don't think that was suggested until after I proposed the recipe that wood ash might have been a major chemical used to prepare the Kaikion. There was no reason to think of ashes as being important until the recipe came along. So I guess it was Dan Perrine, who was a co-author with Carl and myself for the original article in the journal Eleusis. He was the one that came up with some ideas of why, after the fact, when I had suggested ash, he said, well, yes, that might make sense, because ash is referenced here in the literature and in the mythology. And Carl Ruck also came up with some interesting ideas on that. But again, you have to refer to these experts on mythology. I'm a chemist. So talk about molecules, I can do that. Talk about mythology, wow, just I can't remember a thing about a lot of that stuff.
Well. Actually, Carl Ruck is, if he's not there already, he's going to be on his way to Ulysses in the next couple of days there in Greece. So what we've decided to do is I was originally going to record him this week and then have him follow up directly behind you. But he's going to be on in mid-March, fresh back from Greece and Ulysses, to talk about his side of the story. So it should be very interesting.
He should be in a great mood to discuss those things at the time too. Every time, usually he comes back from Greece, he stopped over at my house a couple of times, and he's got an enthusiasm that is totally infectious. I love the guy.
Yeah, I went to his place last April and had a great time. But next question. Who was the first one? You were the first one that proposed the information about ash. That's correct.
Yeah, the reason I proposed that is that when I realized, again, I said to my researchers in Mexico had a part to play in this, because when you manufacture some LSD, the first thing you do is you have to take ergotamine, which is the major toxic alkaloid of ergot, and you have to split it apart by a process called hydrolysis. And so I had read up on all the ways to do this, and when it was first done in the 1930s, the first discovery they made was not how to split apart ergotamine completely, because when you split it apart completely, you get lysergic acid. And lysergic acid, when you react that with diethylamine, of course, you get LSD. But the first few times that they did this, they did it in much milder conditions than they later did it. And the first product that is split off of ergotamine is not lysergic acid, but ergine, or LSA. But this result was completely forgotten, because the discovery of how to make lysergic acid was so important that everybody sort of forgot that early research. But then when I was pondering over this Eleusis problem, I remembered that. And I said, wow, that could probably be the solution. If we take ergotamine and we treat it much more mildly than the complete hydrolysis of lysergic acid, we get LSA, which is the stuff in Ololuqui, and it's the stuff in morning glory seeds. So there we have it. There's the possible recipe. But then I asked myself, well, how could the Greeks do this? They didn't have this chemical, they didn't have that chemical. Ah, but of course, all societies way back to the beginning have wood ashes, and wood ash is a basic chemical. It contains potash, it contains a perlite, which is quite basic, but it's not as basic as the substance that they use to make lysergic acid, which is potassium hydroxide. That's extremely basic. So wood ash seemed to be something that the Greeks had, and it's something, the perfect chemical that you could use to bring about this partial hydrolysis of ergotamine or the toxic ergot alkaloids and make LSA out of it, LSA, which is lysergic acid amide. So it just sort of crystallized out of thin air. This is knowledge I had been sitting on for 20 years. And I had read the Road to Eleusis years before that. And still it didn't occur to me until, one day I said, that's it. These flash ideas, how they come across, it doesn't necessarily happen right away. Sometimes it takes years.
You mentioned you came across some information in the 1930s. Who presented that? And it was overlooked until your discovery, correct?
Yeah, well, there was some chemists in England. I think two of them were called Jacobs and Craig, and they published a couple of articles. Another group did also. And these were the first guys that were taking ergotamine, or the alkaloids of ergot, and trying to find out their structure, their actual chemical structure. It had been unknown to that time. They knew about ergotamine for quite some time, and they even had made ergotamine, but nobody knew exactly the chemical structure. Because, as you know, if you've looked at the structure, it's a complicated the lysergic acid has four carbon rings in it, and the ergotamine part has another several rings in it. It's very, very complex chemical. So the way chemists find out how to draw these diagrams of exactly the structure of a chemical is they take the chemical and they break it apart in various ways. And when they break it apart and then they find it breaks into this stuff and that stuff, and they know what those two stuffs are because they've had previous experience with it, they say, look at those two things. Okay, if we join these together in this way, that's a possible structure. So Jacobs and Craig and others were splitting apart ergotamine to try to find out what the structure was. And so and as I say, the first thing that they discovered was not lysergic acid, but LSA, lysergic acid amide, the stuff of the morning glory seeds. And this was overlooked because within two years, they published another article in which they did the same experiment, but with much stronger base, potassium hydroxide. And they got lysergic acid, and they said, this is the fundamental unit of all the ergot alkaloids. And everybody paid attention to that, and it was sort of forgotten that you could split ergotamine to ergine, because it didn't seem very important, because they said, sure, you can do that, and then if you split ergine, you get lysergic acid, and that's the important chemical. And in a way it is, but not when you wanted to think about how they might have prepared the kaikion of ancient Greece.
So how did you originally come across this theory about the wood ash?
Well, as I've just been describing, it seemed the clues that I had remaining from the research in Mexico and thinking about the kaikion over a couple of years and how it could possibly be psychoactive and not poisonous. As I said, you sit with enough facts for long enough, and you come up with, if you keep thinking about it, you come up with an idea. It's hard to say why I didn't come up with it a lot earlier. That's what's hard to say. I'm sort of embarrassed that I sat on this knowledge for years and didn't come up with it immediately when I had read The Road to Eleusis. It was a mystery to me why you could split up ergotamine into ergine, into LSA, rather than into lysergic acid. Was an annoyance. Maybe that's why I never thought of it. It was like annoying that this happened. Why shouldn't it all, become lysergic acid? So forget about that. Forget about that. Like everyone else, I forgot about it.
How did you test this theory?
Well, in order to really test the theory correctly, what you need is a supply of ergot that has been analyzed so that you know exactly what's in it. You need to know how much. Because ergot, even the ergot that grows on rye or barley, depends on the conditions of growing. If you grow it in a bad season, there's almost nothing in it in terms of alkaloid. If you grow it under ideal climate, it contains quite a lot of alkaloid. So you don't want to just take You know, if you go out in a field, you can find some ergot, but you couldn't really test it. You couldn't really try to make a kaikion potion out of it unless you knew exactly what was in it to start. So here you need assayed ergot. You need a real analytical laboratory to really do this test in such a manner as you could say, okay, it's pretty much proven this is the way they could have done it. So instead of using ergot, what I did was I took some pills that you use for migraine headache. I have migraine headache from time to time. And oddly, I don't know how this is one of those another coincidences of life. The only thing that cures migraines in my case is ergotamine. So I've always had these ergotamine tablets around. So I took some ergotamine tablets and I treated them with the recipe that I proposed. And sure enough, it seems that that when you cook them with wood ashes and water, you get something that's slightly psychoactive. As I said, the tests weren't really definitive because I wasn't able to do them in such a way that I could know exactly how much was converted and whether it was, you know, converted all the way to lysergic acid or that it was mostly LSA. So the tests are only very, what word I'm looking for here? The tests were only a slight confirmation of the theory. We really need some chemist from a big laboratory to come forward and say, okay, I'm going to test your theory. But that doesn't really happen too often. It hasn't happened. Our ideas have been out there for a couple of years, and nobody's come forward to me and say, okay, we're going to do the work now. That's too bad. So I tested it, and the tests that I did three tests. They're reported in my video, and also I reported them at Basel, and nothing's come of it. Nobody wants to either try to disprove it or prove it. That's too bad.
What do you think the impact of your research will be on this field over the generations or next couple of decades, if you're correct?
Well, I hope it's hard to say. I'd like to believe that if we get some positive lab results, somebody takes some assayed ergot and treats it with our recipe in various ways, you know, at different temperatures for different lengths of time, and finds out by an analytical procedure such as a thin layer chromatography or something like that, that the poisonous alkaloids are actually converted to LSA to this extent, to this amount. You know, it's not really difficult to do that. It's not even expensive. It's fairly easy. Anybody that's got access to an analytical chem lab could do this straight off. So I'd like to believe that if that happened, you know, everybody would say, oh, well, okay, it's generally accepted now that that's the way they did it. But, you know, I found out that all scientific research, and this includes psychedelic research too, have an elite, a group of central figures. And usually there aren't really very many revolutionaries in the center of a field of research. It's unfortunate, but most people in the center of a field of research are concerned with, you know, their careers and tenure and getting research money. They do very valuable work, to be sure, but they never really go out on a limb to suggest revolutionary theories. You know, as the philosopher of science Thomas Kuhn described this whole process of how science goes on with a given paradigm for a long time, and everybody's in the center, and they believe this. And slowly, there get to be certain experimental results that disagree with the central paradigm. And yet, everybody sticks to the paradigm for a long time until the anomalous results get so big that it causes a scientific revolution. So even psychedelic research is not immune to this. And I find that a lot of the central figures are doing their thing, and they'll listen to what you have to say, and they'll say, oh, that's interesting, but, you know, they won't help you, really. And, like, nobody's come forward and said, okay, let's test this theory. We want to find out now. Well, okay. So, for better or worse, the kind of science that's normal today, it's like that. People want to maintain their positions, research grants, get tenure. I understand that, you know. I'm on the outside looking in. That gives me a great freedom, but also some limitations that You know, if I come up with some great ideas, even though they seem wild to everybody, they'll just remain on the outside for who knows how long. It's hard to say.
Let's discuss your video, Psychedelics in Eden. What was the premise of this video?
Well, I think I mentioned already that when I was reading The Road to Eleusis, really was not long after it was first published, it occurred to me that psychedelic plants must have played a rather universal role in all of human history. You know, I mean, so why not in human prehistory as well? I mean, shamanism and the use of psychoactive plants appears to go right back to the sources of human existence. So it'd be rather strange if there was not some important tie-in to the way in which advanced apes became human. You know, so I started to look for evidence that the emergence of modern man from his proto-human ancestors might have been brought about, or at least maybe helped along by psychedelic use. And I rather quickly found out a lot more than I thought possible. I wrote a rather dense treatise about it all. I wrote it long. It's very long. And believe me, it is dense. And so it seemed I might reach a wider audience if I made a video, you know, of the major ideas, sort of a nice summary that was easy to understand with lots of pictures. And those people are so used to television since the 1950s and 60s that it gets across more quickly. And if they really get interested, then they can go to your writing and try to wade through, the deep parts of the theory. So I made a video. It's on my website, by the way, and anybody can go there and watch it. And there's some good, a couple of videos by Carl Ruck there also, and some other stuff. I'll give you the link to the website later. Fortunately, my friend Michael Horowitz, Flashback Books, he brought it to the attention, my video, he brought it to the attention of Dieter Hagenbach, who was just then organizing the Hoffman celebration that was going to take place in 2006. So I was very lucky then. I got invited to present my ideas to that event. And so rather than just, do the same thing over again that was in the video, I updated the theory with some new findings. And so it sort of became a Psychedelics in Eden Part 2. And I'm putting together a video of that lecture too, because it's a little bit difficult because I'm using some video that was shot at the celebration in 2006, and then putting the images, re-editing the images so that they're much more clear. I hope to put that up on the website soon too also.
So how did you get started in this area of research? I mean, obviously it's psychedelics, but it sure seems to be a drastic change to me over studying Eleusis and ergot.
Well, maybe it was my my years of not even thinking about anything psychedelic, cruising around on that boat, and then suddenly I read The Road to Eleusis, and wow, it's like a real light of fire under you kind of thing. And I started trying to, anything I could come up with, all sorts of ideas, wild ideas, just put it all together. And oddly, I think Terence McKenna got the same idea as I had about the same time, because he also proposed that psychedelics must have played some important role in human evolution. Terence proposed that the effect of psychedelics, or this so maybe we call it a psychedelic awakening, he proposed that it happened at a much earlier time in human evolution than I eventually did. And this was, it was before he published his book, Food of the Gods. So when was that? That was in the 80s, I guess. We exchanged a couple letters on the subject.
I think he actually published...
And then he went on to publish his book.
I think he actually published that in 92, but go ahead.
Yeah, well, so it was the late 80s, I think we were talking about it, because I remember he had already written a paper on it. I don't know where that was published, but he sent me the paper. And that was, the idea that early man was following the ruminants who went across the fields eating the grass, and then on their droppings would grow the psychedelic mushrooms. Well, it's possible, maybe, but that was, that's a much, much earlier period of human evolution than I eventually proposed. So So anyway, the foods of the god, Food of the Gods got to be a bestseller, but I sort of kept thinking about the idea for a few more years. And that turned out to be a good thing because there were quite a number of developments in different scientific fields that subsequently enabled me to propose that the psychedelic awakening was much more recent than Terence had proposed. Like one of those developments was listeners may be aware of this, it came out in Time magazine and everything. It was called the Eve Theory, because some scientists got together and analyzed human DNA that was in the mitochondria, and they came to the conclusion that that the whole human race originated in East Africa, and very recently, according to the genetic analysis, it happened between 50,000 and 150,000 years ago, and that the whole human race was descended from a few individuals, maybe a couple hundred, but at most, maybe 1,000 individuals. Genetic analysis was, well, of course, there were detractors and people that said, no, humans developed in many parts of the world all at the same time. That was called the multi-regional theory. But anyway, a lot of these developments happened after Terence published his book, so they gave me the opportunity to include those ideas and then come up with a much more, a time frame that there was much more evidence to support it than Terence had.
And, well, what do you feel about McKenna's theory?
Well, in light of these scientific discoveries that happened afterwards, after he published his book, his time frame now seems maybe a mistake. Well, he was the revolutionary. He was bold enough to propose the idea right off, and it was a good thing that he proposed it, because a lot of people became aware of it. Even to the extent that in 1994 they had the first Tucson, Arizona conference on consciousness. It was a very, very big event. Andrew Weil was there, all sorts of consciousness researchers. Consciousness science was just getting big at that time, a lot of people studying it, whereas before, it had been a totally neglected field since the beginning of the 20th century. So anyway, there was another problem happened, though, with Terence's theory, because at the 1994 conference, Andrew Weil was asked about these ideas, about McKenna's ideas, because they were making quite a buzz at the time. And Andrew Weil's reply was essentially that in normal times, in a thriving and stable primate society, primates being our ancestors, the accidental ingestion of a psychedelic drug by an individual would be risky. It'd be more likely to isolate that individual and, as Andrew Weil said, eliminate him from the gene pool. Now, this is really actually quite important because, it's well known that all sorts of animal societies have inbuilt mechanisms to isolate a defective or abnormal individual. So this is part of, the way the inheritance and evolution goes. You have to be able to get rid of the defective ones in order so that the genes improve. Well, that's the theory anyway. Some people may not subscribe to that, but it's pretty well established. Anyway, this is why in my own theory, I propose that the psychedelic awakening didn't occur at a time, in a normal time, when our proto-ancestors there were all well established and having a good time and everything was success, they were going on well. But the time period for my psychedelic awakening, not mine, but the one I propose for a proto-man, was at a time of great upheaval and distress, when there was only a few individuals, and they were hiding out, they were taking refuge from something. Like the normal mechanisms of isolating individuals that weren't quite up to par were all broken down because there was only a few of them. It was a really disrupting time for our species or the species that preceded us. So it seems more likely that the psychedelic awakening would be possible in light of Andrew Weil's reservations about that possibility.
What are you just covered a little bit of it, but what are some of the more strengths and weaknesses regarding McKenna's theory?
Well, as I said, its great strength was that it excited people's imaginations. You know, nobody had ever thought about that before. So it made the idea quite widespread that psychedelics were important throughout human not only throughout human history, but maybe in human evolution also. I think, though, its main weakness, as I see it, was that it was more, more speculation. That's what, more speculation than research. That's what Andrew Weil had to say immediately. He says, it's speculation. Maybe not so wild, but then again, it's just speculation. You got to admit that it's very difficult to find evidence for something like that back on the timescale that Terence proposes. I didn't think I was going to find much evidence from my own timescale, but it turned out to be quite a few lines of evidence. It may seem a difficult task to get evidence for such a theory, and of course, most of it's going to be coincidental. But I mean, when you come up with several lines of evidence, all which point in the same direction, it starts to get to be a strong hypothesis.
Just to interject real quick, I felt that one of the weaknesses in McKenna's theory was that he suggests that these ancient proto-humanoid ancestors would have left the canopy of trees and stumbled across psilocybe types of mushrooms in the grasslands of Africa. But then would not these people have found an even wider variety of psychedelic substances within the canopy of trees than in the grasslands before they left? And wouldn't they have utilized them there, just as the shamans today in the jungles have such a wide understanding of the plants? So, as well, something that I've found is that the general straight population, especially, in some poor regions, seems to outbreed the psychedelic group and not the other way around. And, Terence proposed that people under the influence of psychedelics would outbreed the non-using general public. But looking at the last 40 or 50 years, you would think that the group of people from the 60s and everything, that the population explosion out of that would have been enormous.
Yeah, well, as I say, Terence is a great speculator. When you listen to some of his live lectures, it's fantastic stuff there, but, it's not really really science, which is fine, But, also the problem with us coming down out of the trees and then following the herbivores for the mushrooms that grow on their crottin and their booze. I like the French words for those much better than the American. The problem there is that those prehumans had very small brains still. That was a long time ago when we actually lived in trees. So to propose that was the awakening, I mean, that removes the awakening through many different species where, the brain was growing. I think psychedelics don't really work like we know they do, unless we've already got a very big brain, essentially what we have now. Then, psychedelic use could lead to the birth of shamanism. It could lead to an awakening. I mean, you need language already, or its rudiments, in order to be psychedelically awakened. So, Terence, it was great speculation. It was a great story, but it's like called just so stories, right?
Right.
So I appreciate them. I love them, but as far as a scientific theory, it's pretty weak.
Yeah, well, I released about 70 hours worth of Terence McKenna's talks to the internet, from 2002 to 2004. A friend of mine had died, and she went by the name She Who Remembers, Jeannie Brittingham Erstad. Excuse me, I need a sip of water here, goodness. And she had all of these recordings of Terence McKenna that she had done. Some she had collected, most of them she had recorded herself. And so I released all of these things to the internet over the following years. And, You know, so it's really interesting for me to reflect back, you know, what I thought in the early 90s and late 90s about psychedelics, and even just the amount of information I've taken in over the last 6 or 7 years compared to what I thought back then. But wanted to ask you, do psychedelic drugs cause genetic mutation?
Well, I think most of the research, essentially all the good research, you remember the scandal in the 60s where, you know, suddenly it causes cancer, it causes DNA mutation, everything. Well, that was pretty much disproven. So in terms of actual genetic mutation, I don't think any of the, at least not the major psychedelics, cause any genetic problems. This may come from the idea that, again, this is Terence McKenna who said in his book something that these, the psychedelic awakening involved a mutation. But I don't think he was speaking biologically or scientifically there. I think more likely he had in mind, mutation of the psychology of the animal at the time, or maybe the spiritual, or maybe it was a spiritual or social mutation that took place. In other words, he wasn't really using the word mutation in a scientific sense. So I think that was a confusion that resulted also, because if you want to read it literally, you may say, oh, he said it caused a mutation, and we know that psychedelics don't cause, you know, genetic mutations. So at least for LSD, pure LSD has been shown to be totally non-mutating in terms of the genes.
Where have ancient cultures been shown to utilize psychedelic drugs?
At the beginning of my lecture at Basel for the Hoffman celebration, and also in the video, I show a map that I got out of some scientific, I think it was a Scientific American book on use of psychoactives. And the map is great because it's a world map, and you see all these little icons for all the places that psychedelics were found to exist and were part of some society. And essentially, the map is filled with these icons, right? Except for maybe the extreme Arctic. Basically, everywhere that man went, there was psychedelics being used. So the point here is that psychedelic use among early men was so universal, all over. It could hardly have been something that came into existence independently in all those places. You know, I mean, if it existed all over, if it was something that comes into existence by chance, or you expect it to be here and there, but not here and not there and not there, it's all over the place. So for me, that means that psychedelic use must have been something that existed at the source. In those first human societies that started to migrate out of Africa, you know, about 50 to 75,000 years ago, according to the genetic studies, we all come from there. And if everywhere we went, there was psychedelics being used, to me, that says we used them back then too. We used them right from the very beginning. So if we used them from the very beginning, why not just before the very beginning? And there we have the evolutionary tie-in.
Well, speaking of which, aren't there other animals and species and insects and things like that seek out altered states of consciousness and psychedelic experiences? I know Giorgio Samarini published about this, so probably 7 or 8 years ago.
Yeah, he sent me the book. He used to be the publisher of the journal Eleusis, which has since been sold, but he's the one that thought highly enough of our article to publish it in Eleusis. And he sent me his book on animal use of psychoactives. Let's call them psychoactives when they're being used by animals, because you don't really have a psychedelic experience, which would be mind manifesting. Well, I don't know. Can't rule it out. Does an insect have a mind? Well, it has a nervous system. So it's hard. We have to be careful also, Andrew Weil's warning here, not to jump to conclusions that maybe psychedelics, you know, played roles all over the place in evolution. You know, you got to be scientific about these things, and you know, you got to establish some evidence, even if it's just coincidental, that it's possible. You know, there may or may not be such influence, but it remains to be shown. For me, the importance of Samarini's findings is that, you know, it appears that for most, maybe all animals, a change in conscious state is something that is enjoyed by the animal, you know, not feared or shunned. You know, so the fact that it's enjoyed, it tends to make the animal repeat it. You know, so this sort of sets the stage, you know, for the psychedelic awakening. If in general animals enjoy some kind of a change in consciousness, even if it's eating, you know, an apple that's been fermented a bit and getting, you know, get a bit of a buzz out of it. You know, animals tend to enjoy this. They tend to repeat it, seek it out, even if it doesn't make them, you know, so odd that they get rejected by their society. You know, it's just a little thing. So we wouldn't want to call it psychedelic. It's just that it seems enjoyable. So it's, as I say, it sets the stage for proto-man liking these things, and at the right time in the right place and with the right nervous equipment, it leads to the psychedelic awakening that begins the whole of human history on Earth.
And I should also point out that DMT and 5-MeO-DMT are natural products of the brain and lungs and cerebral spinal fluid. So that's, you know, even that throws in other interesting things. If all of these animals contain psychoactive substances in their brains and blood, what does that say for the rest of all of this?
Says that it's natural. It says that we're crazy in the 20th century to be about the only society that says, oh, these things are, you know, these things are be forbidden. There's something dangerous here. This, you know, this is wrong. So we're about the only society to go that extreme. You know, it doesn't reflect too well on us.
Right. So how do all of these things affect McKenna's original theory?
Well, as I said, perhaps psychedelics actually did play a role in his time frame, and that they affected several of our predecessors at various times in prehistory. It's possible. The problem is, you know, if you want to propose it just as a conjecture, that's fine, you know, but if you want to propose it as a theory, you got to come up with some evidence, you know, and of course, the further back you go, the more difficult it is to get even slim evidence. So it remains speculation. It's interesting, but it's just speculation. So that, you know, as far as animals liking changed consciousness, sure, that's a little bit of evidence that all our predecessors back to whenever you want to consider wouldn't have been against changing their consciousness, but whether that led to something, an evolutionary change, is an entirely different matter. Like I say, we don't want to say that the psychedelics had big roles to play in the evolution of one animal species to another either. That's just complete conjecture. So you have to come up with some evidence. You have to come up with some evidence if you want to be scientific.
What do you have to say about the chromosome and DNA research proposed by Francis Crick and Kerry Mullis? And speaking of you know, Kerry Mullis, he's somebody that I used to know and hang out with sometimes on the weekends, and we would shoot the shit, and, you know, but at the time I didn't have any idea that he had gone public, that his discovery was made or influenced by LSD. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Well... And so it was really encouraging to see public figures, especially ones that have won the Nobel Prize. You know, they have the courage to own up to the importance of psychedelic experience that they've had in their own lives. Kerry Mullis wrote just one of the most enjoyable books about not only that, but his entire, you know, it was really a nice little biographical sketch, his book. I really appreciate that. You know, perhaps it's harder for a scientist or a public figure who's in the middle, you know, he's not really all that famous. You know, he takes a risk. You know, if you've won the Nobel Prize, you're not really taking much risk. But again, it's still very admirable that they were totally honest about this. I wish it would happen more. I wish we wouldn't find people that insisted that they hadn't inhaled. That's really, you know, can't have much respect for those kind of people.
Well, you know, I've
as far as the chromosomes.
Oh, go ahead.
Well, as far as the chromosome, I actually hadn't prepared too much on that. What Francis Crick has to say on that. Are you referring to the fact that he was essentially the person that led to discovery what chromosomes were? But I don't know what he had. I don't think he had to say anything about chromosomes being affected by psychedelics.
I think he, like Carrie Mullis, basically came across his discovery from the use of psychedelics, and that's something that Dr. Stan Grof had discussed with me. But I wanted to say
all the great computer geeks that led to Windows, that led to all the modern computers. They all say that the psychedelic experience were their main influence, too. You know, we can't forget that there was some really great research that was going on just before the scandal of the mid-60s shut it all down. And that was like Jim Fadiman and Willis Harmon and a few other people were doing some research on how creativity could be augmented using very low-dose psychedelic experiences. That was some great research, and it ties in directly with how a lot of these famous people say that what they saw, what they discovered through psychedelic experience was the seed of their discoveries. I mean, it's obvious that this is not only a possibility, but we're fools for not doing much more research on this and using psychedelics in order to help produce the kind of creativity that might save us from blowing up the damn planet. You know, I mean, wow, we're in serious situation today. We need all we can get from inspiration, psychedelic and every kind.
Well, yeah, I agree with you. You know, it's kind of funny. I've been trying to get Carrie to agree to do a documentary film on this area of research and, so far his wife doesn't want him to do the documentary film because he's working to get this new professorate position, and she's afraid that if he does this video project, and in fact even if he comes on this show, that it will negatively impact his presentation to the world, even though he's well gone public with it.
Well, that's what I was talking about before, about the mainstream scientists have always this not only risk, but they always have to be. It's sad that science is like this, but you have to be overly concerned with your position, with tenure, with getting research funds, with not offending the wrong people. It's tragedy that science is like. It didn't used to be like this. You know, the great scientists of yesteryear used to be people who had private funding and they could do damn well what they pleased. Even over the objections of the Pope. But these days, there's a much more powerful force than the Pope. It has to do with money.
Well, that's true. Let me ask you, how did Aldous Huxley's writing in the Doors of Perception affect your own work?
Well, as part of that very dense treatise that I mentioned that I was writing, I wanted to come up with a new idea of how psychedelics worked. I went back to Huxley's great book, The Doors of Perception, and I discovered that he probably had found the secret right off. This is after one experience. He discovered the secret. But the secret was was something very simple and very transparent. It wasn't obvious. So even he missed it, and everyone else missed it since then. They didn't realize what this initial effect of the psychedelic drug was.
Let me ask, what about the locus coeruleus? What does that have to do with your theory, and what's the importance of it?
Well, as I said, Huxley discovered the secret, and the secret, your listeners really should watch my video because there's quite a long presentation. There's a lot of things that I draw into this. But essentially, the secret is the significance of things. What happens when you take a psychedelic drug is suddenly you realize that almost everything is extremely significant, has a big, things matter a lot more. Even within your own thoughts, you think about something that happened to you in the past and you say, gee, you know, I never thought of it that in that way. That was a really important event in my life, and it led me to thinking this and this and this. Well, if you read Huxley's book, I could read you some of the quotes from it. But anyway, he's sitting there in his study, and he's looking at things, and he's saying, you know, he's looking at this table, and he says, wow, the table suddenly thrust itself upon my awareness. It became the most significant thing in the environment. And the books, you know, the books were like thrusting themselves off the shelves to impress me with their significance. That's what woke me up to the fact that that is the real fundamental underlying effect of psychedelics. Suddenly, the significance of things takes on a magnitude that you never suspected. You know, something everyday, simple everyday thing that you just, you know, you overlook all the time. Suddenly, it means something. Not even something that you can describe, but suddenly there's a significance in things that just becomes overwhelming. Well, for me, that was the secret to the initial cognitive or psychological effect of psychedelics. So as I refer back to my video, because if you watch the video, you know, you'll see that there's much more to present here than I can do in a summary. But anyway, as you mentioned here, you asked about the locus coeruleus. The locus coeruleus is a little tiny blue spot on the brainstem, and it's the center of the brain system that works with the neurotransmitter called norepinephrine. Now, of course, there's been a lot of concentration with psychedelics on the other important system that seems to govern lots of primitive and underlying functions of the brain, and that's the serotonin system. And the center of the serotonin system also actually is several small nodes on the brainstem. These are called the Raphe nuclei. Anyway, what occurred to me, and it was very interesting because a paper I came across in a book which was titled 50 Years of LSD, this paper actually came close to proposing what I developed in my theory, but it seemed that they discovered this and then they forgot about it. The research I mentioned involves how these two systems interact, the norepinephrine and the serotonin system. It turns out that the locus coeruleus and its norepinephrine system, among many other things that it does, seems to control the serotonin system in such a way that we could propose that the locus coeruleus is a center of a brain system which automatically detects how important something is. For instance, you know, if suddenly you're sitting in your living room and a lion comes in the door, you realize that that's an important event in your life and maybe your death too. You know, there's an automatic system in the brain. There's an automatic ability to recognize immediately something that is very important in your environment. And this extends even to when you come up with an idea. You know, it's the aha experience. You come up with an idea, you know, you're pondering this and that and the other thing about some problem you have, and bam, some idea comes into your brain. It's like when that chemist who discovered, you know, that benzene was a six-membered ring. He said it came to him in a dream, and he instantly, you know, was impressed with the importance of that idea. Well, you know, it's not some logical thing that you think about that detects this salience or this significance. It's something automatic that happens to us. When something important occurs, we see it right away somehow, or we hear it right away, or we detect it in our own ideas right away. Well, my idea, and this ties in with Huxley's significance of the books thrusting themselves off the shelves, my idea was that there is an actual system in the brain which does this, which refers to everything that we know, like we know that a lion is dangerous, so when one comes into our view field, we pay attention to it immediately. Not only dangerous, but, you know, like when somebody passes a plate of our favorite food under our noses, yeah, that wakes us up instantly too. We don't have to calculate and say, you know, it smells like an avocado, but it smells also like a steak, and I know what it is. Ah, I like that. Oh, no. You don't, it's not calculated. Something happens automatically. So that was what tied in with Huxley's idea, that the initial effect is the magnification of the detection of importance, the detection of significance, the detection of salience in our field of view, in our hearing, and even in the stream of ideas that's going on in your head. You know, somehow we can detect something that is salient or important. We detect it automatically and right away. So this is the basis of my whole theory of the initial effect of psychedelics. Somehow, when you take a psychedelic, at least one of the major ones, I wouldn't say, you know, some of the things we call psychedelic are maybe, you know, like maybe they're actually more hallucinogens than psychedelic. So let's really just stick with the three major psychedelics here. And when we're talking about this salience detection system, I think you can show that at least the three major psychedelics do this. They seem to turn up the gain on this salience detection system from a level which during normal life, everyday life, the level of salience detection is fairly low, because it seems to me through evolution, we have the ability to detect an amazing significance in something if it's really dangerous or if it's really important, and that rarely do we detect that much significance in something. That our normal detection from day to day is just up or down, maybe from 10 to 20%, let's say, on this scale of detection. And then suddenly you take a psychedelic drug and boom, everything becomes significant to maybe a 90% or more. And then that leads to the whole psychedelic experience, because when all these things are important, you tend to follow the leads that they imply to a level, in a way which you would never do automatically. And when you do that, then, as I said, your stream of consciousness is producing things which are even more significant than before. And that causes like sort of a feedback effect, that everything gets tremendously significant and you follow things through to places that you would never go on your own. And that's dependent all on the set and setting, your attitude, the place you are. It was always a mystery to me why the original researchers couldn't think of anything but set and setting. They said, well, the whole experience depends on set and setting. Well, fine, but in a way, that's got to be ignoring something. What starts that all off? What is the original psychological effect? Well, this is the idea I came up with. Turn up the gain on the salience detection system till, wow, everything is just pounding you with its importance. And then you put things together. You put two and two together, and not only two and two, but all sorts of things you put together that you just don't do on your own. And you that takes you back to your early life. That takes you back, takes you into places that you would have never imagined. So that's the basis of my theory. I encourage people to go look at the evidence that I've collected for it, because I think it's at least merits us to consider this theory as a main contender. Because for me, the neuroscientists and the psychedelic scientists haven't come up with, they're really fascinated with the receptors and neurotransmitters, and that gets more and more and more complicated. But they haven't come up with like a global theory of how the brain works. I mean, does it work like a computer? Well, not really. Does it act as if it were a computer? Well, not really. You know, nobody really has. Well, here I've started with at least a global theory. Here is a function that we can posit that the brain has, the salience detection, which could very well be the initial effect. So it's the start of something, at least. I hope that we could come up with a general theory of how these things work. Nobody seems to be working on that. I don't know why. I love the work on receptors, but it's so damn complicated. I mean, who could follow it? And who could say, we found the receptor that causes psychedelic experience? Oh, no. It's not a receptor. You know, the receptors are on the, that's the very basis of the whole thing. That's the entry level on a molecular scale. What we need to do is start from the middle, from how brain systems, which control or represent various cognitive activities, work. That's where we need to start. When we know something there, then we could go down to the receptors and say, ah, those are the receptors that are doing this, right? But to start at the receptor level and expect to work yourself up to psychedelic experience and consciousness, I think that's going to be a hard slog, a very hard slog. So let's start for my part, I start in the middle and I find out this cognitive operation, which I call it, which is the detection of salience. Then we go down and we say, oh yeah, look, the locus coeruleus is controlling that. And the way it's doing it is it's controlling the gain on the serotonin system. Then the receptor research becomes very important because we know the middle level, we know the cognitive operation, the psychological manifestation that it results in, right? And then we can go up from there, hopefully, to how that changes consciousness. No, the mind and the brain, I mean, that's, we're never going to find out a whole lot about that in a way that we found out about chemistry or in a way we found out, that's the big mystery. I'll leave it off for there, and hopefully you can think of a question after all that.
Well, let's see. How does cognitive neuroscience and its application apply to your theory?
Well, as I said, I have very marginal knowledge of the center of all this. The neurosciences, the cognitive neurosciences, I mean, you got to spend your whole life with that to really know most of it. And I've got some big, thick books on the subjects, but basically I only picked and choose stuff that supports my theory. I've tried to look at it broadly enough so that I don't see I'm just using a part of it in an illegitimate way. But, the cognitive neurosciences are what led me to think in terms of the middle ground here, like trying to think about it. Oh, yeah, here's one thing I wanted to mention. This idea that we need to know what the cognitive operations are before we go start looking at what receptors are involved. With vision, we know this much better than the other places because vision is easy to, how we see things, it's much more easy to do experiments than with the way we think when we're thinking about some philosophical problem, for example. Like in the visual cortex, we know that there's an area that detects the edges of things, there's another area that detects the color, there's another area that detects the movement. So like these are the cognitive operations that occur in the visual cortex. You know, there's all these cognitive operations of edge detection, movement detection, color detection, and finally all those are combined, and then we have a seamless view of something. So there we know that, there we see that there are certain cognitive operations in the middle, which each of which are affected, brought about by various receptors and neuron signalings. And then in the end, we get the conscious experience of the vision. So I'm proposing that's really, just because it's easier in vision to do experiments, what it demonstrates is that's the way we should be working. We shouldn't just go to neuroscience and try to get all the information there is on receptors, and then suddenly it's going to all fall together and explain what consciousness is. Well, I don't even think the neuroscientists are hoping that, but I'm just making a demonstration there that I think that neuroscience is spending too much time down below on all the nitty-gritty, and there's not anybody really working in the middle or on a global theory of what all consciousness is. It's too hard, and there's not enough research money there because, don't forget, we like to work on receptors and everything because there that leads to new drugs, which people can make a profit on, so there's lots of money there. And also, when we're working on receptors and neuron signaling, that simulates what we think a computer, it looks like the brain is working like a computer there, so we can make all sorts of theories there. So, the forces of science are pushing people down there where they're going to get lots of results, but not really any wisdom. So, I use the example of the visual cortex to show that we got to have more research in the middle. We got to, like I've done, we've got to try to come up with the cognitive operations that involve thinking about something, not just seeing something, but thinking about, some important topic. And I'm saying that I propose that one of those very important cognitive operations is the detection of salience. So this is you know, a proposal within the realm of cognitive neuroscience as far as I can see it. I can't become an expert in that subject. I studied chemistry. I did psychology and all that stuff when I was I was in university. Well, ignore that. Chemistry is hard. You can really understand it. it's pretty almost exact. I loved it. Whereas all the sciences of man, they're so nebulous. Who could put up with them? Well, finally, I realized I had to put up with them. And I saw there was a lot of interesting stuff going on there, but I'm not an expert for sure. But as I say, that's what I propose. Here's one cognitive operation we got to pay attention to, the detection of salience. And I said, upon that, all sorts of other things might be built if we could only do the research to find them.
Let me ask you this. Are you familiar with Professor Michael Winkeman's research in this area?
No, I've seen his name, I think, in one of my books or two. I'd have to go read it again. I sort of stopped reading all these subjects a few years ago, one reason or another. I'm more concentrated on the evolutionary theory, more recently, because that led to Basil. But I'd like to go back and, like, this dense treatise I keep mentioning, it's on my website. I'd like to completely redo that and finally publish it, but that's a big work. So I've been holding that off for my old age, and now I've discovered I'm old, so I better get to it.
Well, Michael Winkelman has just published a brand new book just a couple of weeks ago, and I'm going to have him on the show in the next week or two, and it's called Supernatural. Supernatural is Natural, a Biocultural Approach to Religion, and he wrote that with John Baker. So maybe if I remember, I'll send you a link when the show is posted so you can check out what he's got to say on that. I wanted to ask you, and you were talking about the locus coeruleus earlier, does it react or detect various circumstances? You said mostly react, but I wanted to get a little bit more information about that from you.
Well, the center of the road view has been that it reacts, that they do research in mice because you can't really connect up to a person's locus coeruleus because it's way in there and you'd have to destroy part of the brain to get there. So research on humans is out. Even using brain scan techniques, the locus coeruleus is so tiny, brain scanning techniques involve much larger areas, so it's very difficult to track what the locus coeruleus is doing in a human. However, in mice, for instance, where you can sacrifice them without too much protest, they discovered, for instance, that in a mouse, the locus coeruleus gets very active when you threaten the mouse with a cat, for instance. But it does exactly the same thing when you put the mouse's favorite cheese in front of him. The scientists say, looks like this is the locus coeruleus reacts to all sorts of significant things. And that's as far as they really took it. But my idea was then that it's not a reactor. It doesn't just react to this. I mean, because it's not there to react blindly to something that's significant. For me, it's the part of the brain which controls the rest of the brain in such a way as to automatically detect. You see, that was the difference. So it may be sort of a fine distinction in some sense, whether it detects or reacts. But when you want to talk about the rest of my theory, then you'd have to say, yes, the locus coeruleus is the center of a brain-wide system, because the locus coeruleus is connected everywhere. Frontal cortex, top, back, connected to the Raphe nucleus, connected everywhere. It's a very important system. Nobody really has made any global theory again about why that is or what it does. I think that's the whole secret. Let's detect brain systems that represent cognitive operations. Then go to the neurons and the receptors to see how that works. So for me, it's a detector, whereas maybe for a lot of scientists, it's just reacting.
Okay. Okay. And does salience negate the authenticity and enormity of the psychedelic experience?
Yeah, well, that's a great question, because you would think so, and your first impression might be that would be the case, but no. Actually, it makes the authenticity and the normality of psychedelic experience much more important, and it does that because we can see that the drug is only doing a relatively simple thing at the very beginning. And that is the catalyst upon which we then go ahead and do the psychedelic experience. It's all us. It's all we. It's all our own psychology, our own memory, our own unconscious, our own conscious, our own expectations. You see, it's all us, because it's only that initial spark that matters that the drug is doing. The drug is not taking us back to our childhood. The drug is not doing any of that stuff. The drug only does this one little thing in the beginning. It whips up the gain on the salience detection system, and then we take it from there, you see. So what we do is what's important. That's why the psychedelic experience under this theory becomes totally natural and totally authentic.
Interesting. And how would you say your theory plays on normal daily intelligence versus intelligence brought on under exceptional circumstances like the psychedelic experience?
Shows us incrementally how to do all this by ourselves. You know, so what normal daily intelligence is something that's evolved over a long time, and it's mainly concerned with survival and reproduction, and that's about it. You know, and that's what we can expect out of our nervous systems and out of our evolutionary inheritance, unless we have unusual influences. So the psychedelic experience is about the most unusual and powerful influence you can have, and it's thus the most powerful and greatest teacher that we have. Now, Alan Watts said, you know, once you get the message, hang up the phone. When people were asking him whether you continue to take psychedelics all the time, forever, you know, every day or every week. And I'm sort of midway between that. You know, I think that, yes, you can hang up the phone, not permanently, but for more and more extended periods of time. If you've paid attention to what your psychedelic experiences have shown you, you got more and more to work with. And obviously, it's going to take more and more of your time to do so. So therefore, you know, that's the teacher. That's how our normal daily intelligence, which under normal circumstances isn't really concerned with very deep matters. You know, that's how the teacher of the psychedelic experience can show us a way to be much more concerned with things that on our own and with our inheritance of what it means to just be at the end of this long evolutionary pathway. It can show us that there's something far beyond that, something we'd never come across by ourselves. So I hope that answers the question.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good answer. Let me ask you one more question before we start wrapping things up. What does Mount Toba's eruption 75,000 years ago have to do with your theory?
I forgot to mention that before, because when I was talking about the time frame for Terence McKenna's psychedelic awakening versus my own, and my own idea that because of Andrew Weil's criticism that in a normal, stable society that taking psychedelics would be more likely to isolate an individual than make him a leader, I therefore chose to look for a time when the society of our proto-human predecessors was greatly disrupted and perhaps at risk of becoming extinct, you know, the time of great crisis, because then, during such a time, the normal rules don't apply anymore. So I looked and I found that this great volcanic eruption happened in the Philippines, or was Indonesia, Mount Toba. 75,000 years ago, there was an eruption there that probably the world hadn't seen for a long time and probably might not see again. It was so big that I think it was something 100 times or more the size of Mount St. Helens. Actually, in places in England, they've recorded that a couple of feet of volcanic ash was deposited. This is in England, you know, halfway around the world and in the Northern Hemisphere. So it was a fabulous eruption, and we can consider that it must have caused really a volcanic winter and threatened a lot of species with extinction. So it seemed, and this ties right in with the genetic evidence, that between somewhere between 50 and 100,000 years ago, the whole of the human race, or the pre-human race, was reduced to a few individuals. So it fits perfectly with that time, that time zone. 75,000 years ago, Toba erupts. Lots of species become extinct. The sea level drops because there's drought all over the place. And our predecessors are whittled down to a few, whereas they had existed pretty much all over Africa before that. They're whittled down to a few, and a few remnants from one of our societies retreats to the Ethiopian highlands in order to find where there is still plants and water and enough to survive on. So that was my time frame. That's when it happened. What was the psychedelic used? Well, I don't know. Maybe it was even because the ice age was coming on at this period, you know. And as the ice sheets advanced in the northern hemisphere, of course, all the species that were native to Siberia and the more northern areas retreated to the south. Perhaps Amanita muscaria existed at that time in the Ethiopian highlands. And that would tie in, of course, with the story that is revealed in Carl Ruck's research about the medieval churches showing Amanita muscaria and Adam and Eve gathering around. I don't know. There's all sorts of things that tie in. You can get way too far into mere speculation, as we mentioned was Terence's habit. Not a bad thing, but... I'd like to base things as much as possible on things that we know. So that's why my psychedelic awakening happens at this time of crisis, 75,000 years ago. Again, there's quite a bit more of that in my video lectures. So if your readers would want to, or your listeners would want to go view those, that would be great.
Why don't you go ahead and plug your website? And again, your video is Psychedelics in Eden, as well as you are in the 30th anniversary edition that just came out of the Road to Ulysses. But give your website and any other information you want to provide.
All righty. Just psychedeliclibrary.org. But you've got to put the hyphen between psychedelic and library, right? That's if you do psychedelic point library, you won't get it. If you make it all one word, you won't get it. So it's www.psychedelic-library.org. And if you go there, you'll see a nice little illustration of Ergot right on the front page there. And a very interesting thing, a little poem from the Masnavi, which was a medieval Sufi poem. And, you go read the poem. It's talking about what I think is lingering knowledge right into the Middle Ages of what happened at Eleusis.
I think I've already read that. I liked it there. Go ahead.
And right below the poem is a link saying new to the psychedelic library. I forget that. That's what it says. Anyway, that's the link. You go there, and there's two videos by Carl Ruck there, and my video, Psychedelics in Eden, and some more other recent things there, a couple of papers of mine. And I think the original paper in the Eleusis Journal is there also for you to read. So you can explore the rest of the library, but under new to the psychedelic library, the first link underneath the poem of the Masnavi, that's the one to go to, and you can get access to all these things we've been talking about.
Great. And what would you like people to take away from this interview?
Aha! Simply an intention to be a revolutionary. I mean, when you hear something exciting and interesting, try to follow through, see where it leads. Read books. You know, wade through scientific papers. It's not as difficult as it seems at first. I mean, don't depend on the mainstream scientists to do it. Most often they would like to, you know, but they have other priorities.
And that's exactly what we're doing here. So, you know, and I mentioned to you before, this is, a way for independent researchers and academic researchers to really share a lot of information and things. And so I really appreciate your time coming on, and you've got some fascinating information.
Thank you very much, Jan, for having me on. I've got to go to your website all the time and see who's new there, because it's, as I said, I'm embarrassed to not even know about it before this.
All right. Well,
and by the way, I'm not trying to say anything wrong about mainstream scientists. It's just that they have the things they have to do. Luckily, we're revolutionaries. We have the things we have to do.
I agree with that statement totally. And that concludes podcast number 19. Until next week.